Okay. One of the good features about that mirror image concept was the fact that here in this program control office, as far as the funding and schedules went, contractual applications and these sort of things, is that we could deal directly with our counterpart office in Washington. In other words, I was free to get on the telephone and call the Apollo program control chief in Washington and work problems with him without going through Dr. Rudolph and whoever was chief of industrial organizations at O'Connor. That time, like O'Connor or Lee James, and then going through Reese, center management, and those sort of things. See, we could work the problems directly at a fairly low level and say, hey, this is the solution. Now, of course, there were certain major type things that had to funnel through those channels and certain changes in direction and program directives and things that went there. But essentially, you could work the guts of the problem at this detail.
Okay, we've kind of discussed the relationship you had, you know, from your level down. Now, what kind of problems did you work out between yourself and headquarters, for example, going up?
Oh, well, I guess it'd be hard pressed to say. Most of those problems were, I don't think launch vehicles, Roger, was ever the pacing problem in the Apollo program itself. It was always a spacecraft or something else. And I'm really hard pressed to think of a pretty high level type problem that we here resolved with headquarters. Now, there were certain schedule deliveries and reallocation of resources, things, but these were more on a day-to-day program. And as I remember, most of the time, launch vehicle-wise, we were doing our program for less than the amount of resources had been planned, and essentially we ended up bailing other organizations out, like Houston, the spacecraft, and all by taking dollars or offering up dollars out of the launch vehicle program to be applied to their problems.
Yeah, Rudolph once said the figure they were turning, I think this is maybe overall center, but they were turning back $30 to $40 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that Marshall's management was better because of the laboratories, or how do you? That seems to be a pretty remarkable thing to have occurred. Just good management?
Roger, I would have to say that certainly a large portion of that was good management, because even up until this past year, FY73, we gave about 8.8. No, this is in FY74. We see that we can give about $8.8 million back, which headquarters has used to help the Skylab payload problem. Now, you know, anybody can use all of their resources. Anybody can overrun. I can overrun a program. You can. That's no management at all to me. I think anybody can overrun a program. Adding people and time and this, that, and the other. But it takes a pretty good manager to constantly underrun a program. And it takes some good management techniques to go along with it, in my opinion. I think it's more than a seat of the britches manager. I think, you know, this team approach, Dr. Rudolph had a lot of good people working for him, a lot of good dedicated people that really all put their shoulder to the wheel and were able to accomplish this. You know, one thing strikes out in my mind, having worked in private industry for over 10 years and working here at the government in the height of the Apollo program, I would have to say that I saw more dedicated people here in the government working on the Apollo program, trying to get a man on the moon who worked overtime without pay and who worked 24 hours solving problems and who worked weekends making presentations to higher management to tell them where the problem were and making recommendations what to do about it than I ever saw in private industry. And I make that remark because you hear so many people say the government's just a bunch of goof-off people, you know.
Do you think that situation is the same today, or is it kind of peaked off now that the program is kind of peaking down a little bit?
I personally feel it's peaked off a little bit since the program is. And I can't speak for the shuttle people over there, of course. I'm not in that organization. But I know in our program it has peaked out a little bit.
Is that, too, just kind of the inevitable reaction of a maturity of a center or something like that, or maturity of a program?
Well, yeah, and I think it's just when you have these kinds of people on the job, and once you're over the hill, these people tend to start looking for new challenges, you know, new jobs to be done. It's going to really tax them. They don't really want to coast down home free. We find it somewhat hard to get good people like Mac and Bob Shepherd and others to stay on a program. I think they'd rather get on a new program. It's got problems where everything's hustle and bustle,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we've got to have good people to close out the program. You can't just walk off and leave. You know, we still got to support the remaining two Skylab launches and an ASTP launch.
Right.
And you've got to keep a nucleus or a cadre of people around to do that job.
That raised an interesting, this is really not pertinent, I suppose, but one of the things that struck me, we were talking to somebody in Washington, he said sometimes they didn't always figure enough money for a program. It's partly this thing, you know, that once you get the hardware, you've got to keep it in good shape, and you've got to keep the people around to make sure it stays in good shape. And they hadn't really, it's obvious maybe now, but they hadn't really figured on it. You know, they figured, okay, we get the hardware ready to go, that's it.
That's right.
But there are these recurring and sustaining costs that over a long period of time can keep it going up.
That's right. The people are a big thing. We found, I know in the, if I can give you an example, in the F1 engines, they have a procedure of welding these cooling tubes in the bail portion of the chamber.
Right, regenerative stuff.
Right. And they went to great lengths when they finished that to document the welding technique. They made movies of the best welder they had on the job very thoroughly. He did it exactly this way, that way. They wrote up procedures that told precisely how that guy did that job. They finished welding the last one. They laid the guy off. He went home. I don't know, 18 months later, they had need to build another chamber, you know. So they took a guy who wasn't a new welder now. He was a certified welder, and they asked him to do this job. The guy went through the procedures. He reviewed the films. He practiced, but he couldn't do the job. He ended up having to call people back in to do that job.
Yeah.
And there are just some techniques that come through doing this job over time that seemingly you can't document. Now,
okay, and I've heard this, you know, engineers thinking about something, will it work or will it won't work, and there's a gut feeling.
Yeah.
It's either going to go or not going to go. It's the same thing with
that,
this kind
that's
of technique.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And it was amazing. And there they had movies, written procedures, documented, checked, and rechecked.
Yeah.
And you call a new guy in, and even though he's a certified welder, he just can't start and do the job. There's just a certain technique there that, boy, you don't know what it is.
Okay, let me ask something about managerial techniques, and especially in terms of Rudolph. Now, in some place, I think it was set up that, well, let me ask you this. Did Rudolph have daily staff meetings, or only, well?
Rudolph had frequent staff meetings. I don't believe he had daily staff
somewhere
meetings.
Somewhere in the PEP, there was something about daily meetings, but I had the impression that they weren't necessarily
Rudolph had weekly review type meetings,
yeah,
and in-depth, very thorough monthly reviews. I know I have stood in the control center and on my feet and presented all day just on schedules and problems. When Lee James came aboard, he asked me to set up a weekly staff meeting, and we did this in a little matrix format that said the first 15 minutes we'll cover this item, the next 5 minutes we'll cover these kinds of things. But then, once a week, we would have a 15-minute presentation by each stage manager or staff guy on a rotating basis. We just went around and then started all over on whatever his most significant problem was, no matter how minor he thought it was, he had to present that to management. What the problem was, what the alternatives were, what the projection was. And some of these turned out to be quite significant. In the guy's opinion, he should never have presented to management. But once again, the system that we had established made him bring up that problem. And maybe somebody else had a tie-in that they saw how relevant this was, and it could have been a program stopper, you know, or at least a delay. But the thing there again was identified early enough for corrective action to be taken to resolve it so that it did not become a real problem. It was a potential problem. But if you had left it up to the manager on his own, the stage manager now, most likely he would not have brought that out of his own accord until it was too late. And it would have caused a schedule.
But he was under this kind of directive to make sure that it was brought out.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. puts a lot of pressure then on the individual.
It does. It puts a lot of pressure.
They really seem to have responded to it.
They responded. They felt responsible, and they responded.
Okay, and management has to be careful in this situation then, that it's taken in the general atmosphere of we're all in this together, and it's not, you know, like whipping the poor guy because he fell through or something.
Now, that's right. Now, we did have a manager or two that felt he had been whipped like that. He felt that he was being made an example of or embarrassed before other managers. But that was a personal feeling and was never, you know, the intent.
Yeah.
It was more the guy's personality that became involved with the thing, and he resented it to a degree.
Yeah. That's one of the difficulties of writing this kind of a thing, you know, it's out of, you know, there are all kinds of personality aspects of this thing that's hard to bring out. Rudolph must have been a good manager then?
I'd say Rudolph was a good manager. He was a dedicated manager and certainly one of the hardest working managers I've ever seen.
The fact that he was in headquarters for something like a couple of years in the OMSF office, do you think that this was helpful to him when he came back down here and that he knew, you know, how headquarters was operating and how they managed?
You're talking about Rudolph or Lee James?
Rudolph. I was under the impression he worked in the OMSF for a while, from about 61 to 63.
You know, he could have, but that was the time when I was over in the ME lab and I really wasn't associated. And I'm really not aware of the fact that Rudolph was at headquarters for that period.
I'll have to check on that. Maybe
yeah,
I'm wrong.
It could be that I'm just not aware of it.
Yeah,
you could
be
exactly right. I'd say you should check on it, though, because I've never heard that. Now, Lee James was at headquarters.
Yeah. One of the things, too, that strikes me, again, as we've been talking about visibility, and so the Program Control Center really stands out as a real vehicle for this visibility you're talking about.
Yes, very definitely.
It provided the arena for this.
That's right. This is where it all came together, and all the problems were made it up to see whether they could be worked in parallel or series, or what, you know, popped a balloon out over here. And I think it was a tremendous management tool.
But after a while, as I recall, you got to the point where you found that PERT wasn't so useful.
That's right.
By that time, the stages, even maybe the S2 was. It caught up in the manufacturing.
That's right. In the research and development, the early phases of the program, that was a tremendous tool. Later on, as the program gained a degree of maturity and we left the development and started into the manufacturing phase where we were cranking them out the tube, that became less significant as a management tool, and eventually we dropped it because we just didn't see a need for it. And that was another factor in itself, Roger, is the flexibility of the system to change and update itself and adapt to the change in environment and the change in degree and maturity of the program. It wasn't that you develop PERT and now you're going to keep it till you die, till you wrap up the program. I think the system itself helped point out to us that hey, you know, this has been a good tool, but you really don't need it now. So drop it and get something else, or do something differently, or at least revise it. And we had change. We've had change in techniques, you know, all the way through this thing.
Did headquarters ever interfere, or was there a period when headquarters interfered too much in terms of technical things, or were the program offices pretty much left to their own?
I think there was a time when headquarters tried to interfere too much, and I think they wised up quick enough to back off so that they really didn't interfere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, was that during the Holmes
Yeah,
period,
yeah. I'd say that was back in the early.
And Joe Shea.
Yeah, in the early days of the program.
And the 1963 reorganization kind of changed this cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Would you think that was, well, Holmes left then, so there was naturally a change in personality.
Yeah, there's a change in personality. You get a new management.
But is it correct to assume then that Miller was aware of this problem and maybe eased off on the technical interference from the headquarters level?
Miller eased off, but real slowly, because he was an in-depth technical guy himself, and he enjoyed probing into those things.
Yeah.
I think he did ease up a little, but I'd say it really wasn't until after his administration that headquarters really said, hey, let's get out of that and let's leave that up to the guys that know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to have a tendency to want to be an engineer, you know.
They like to get their hands dirty.
Yeah, and solve the problem. But as far, you know, as the Program Control Center and the system we had here, headquarters adapted the Marshall system, in effect.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. They did not have an original control center. They did not use all the procedures and techniques. They came down and viewed ours in the Sam Phillips era and then went back and established one of their own. Now, Sam had been used to Air Force control centers and techniques somewhat of a similar nature, and he knew how they worked.
Well, how is your control center different, for example, from the Air Force concept technique?
I'm not sure because I don't know that much about it. I know we looked at a lot of the Air Force techniques and things and revised or adapted some of them to suit ourselves. We didn't, you know, reinvent the wheel in each case.
Yeah. I have the feeling that the control center here was much more, I hesitate to use the word elaborate, but it was much more comprehensive, maybe, in terms of the data presented, and in terms of this, you know, pinpointed individual, and in terms of the matrix management that was part of the control center.
It was much more comprehensive than anything used heretofore, I'll say that.
Yeah.
I don't.
Would you say that this was the model for the control centers that developed at the Cape, for example?
Definitely.
And at Houston, that predated that.
Definitely.
Thing.
Yeah.
But the control center at MTF came in at about the same time.
They came up with an adaption originally of what they called a think tank concept down there that sort of developed about the same time, as I recall.
Yeah, this was in 65. I think it finally got started here, isn't that right?
Yeah, about 65, really. But we had done a lot of work on it for a couple of years before in writing these procedures, but we just didn't get them implemented formally, Roger.
Uh-huh.
I really think this control center right here on the third floor set the precedent for NASA.
Hmm.
I think as early as the days of Mr. Webb, the first administrator, if you'll look up some of his early comments, he made a review down here, and he used to send people down to review this center and what we were doing here, and he had very complimentary comments about the control center and its operation back early in his days.